Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 285. How can you move your MCP tools beyond plain text? How do you add interactive UI components directly inside chat conversations? This week on the show, Den Delamarski from Anthropic joins us to discuss MCP apps and interactive UIs in MCP. Den is a member of the MCP Steering Committee and a core maintainer focusing on auth and security. He explains how MCP acts as a universal bridge, providing AI models with the real-time context they need. He shares insights on working with MCP apps and moving beyond simple text to render web-based user interfaces directly in your chat window. Den previously worked on GitHub SpecKit, and we discussed taking advantage of spec-driven development and how to use skills to remove the toil from your workflow. We also talked briefly about his podcast and his conversations about navigating careers in technology. This episode is sponsored by Agent Field. Most of us think of AI as a chat window, but what happens when agents move into your back end, simulating market scenarios and acting on them, routing patients across hospital networks, optimizing fleet logistics in real time, all autonomously? That's the AI backend. Agent Field is the open source framework for building it. Search Agent Field on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Den, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you. Anthony Shaw connected me with you. Yeah, I don't know how many months ago.
Friend of the pod.
Yeah, totally. And we've kind of been going back and forth, and there's reasons for that as far as getting you scheduled, I think, which we'll discuss. You know, why we're having you on, talk kind of about MCP, and you're a member of the MCP steering committee and core maintainer. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're still focused on auth and security, but that's something I'm interested in as far as MCP goes, because I think that's a very interesting hot area also.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I wanted to start by talking about your podcast, The Work Item. Maybe tell me a little bit about it and how long you've been doing it.
Yeah, totally. So that's a good way to start the show. Talk about my podcast.
I don't mind. I love cross-promoting.
I do have a podcast. It's called The Work Item, and it is a show where I talk to people about their careers in tech. It actually has a fairly interesting origin story because back in like during the pandemic days, everybody was starting their podcast, right?
Yeah, sure.
Everybody's like, everybody's just cooped up inside their apartment or house. And they're like, what are we going to do? We're just going to, you know, talk to our friends and record ourselves. So I did start that with a friend of mine, Courtney Cotton, who him and I ran the first couple of seasons of the podcast because our main thing was we wanted to learn about how people approach their careers in tech. Because if you work in tech, you know that sometimes a lot of the paths to, like, I don't know, if you want to get to the next level of recognition, the next level of responsibility, like those paths are fairly opaque. Like you,
yes,
you know, like you read a lot of books about, you know, how to get started with this and how to become an engineer or product manager or whatever. And that's super cool. It's a good starting point, but the higher you progress, the more you start running into basically these invisible walls. Like, well, I don't know how to become a staff engineer.
Yeah.
I don't know what it takes to be a CTO of a company or a CEO of a company. And out of that, we're like, well, what's the best way to get those insights? And you're not going to just reach out to random people and be like, hey, can I like borrow 15 minutes of your time to tell me about what it's like to be a CTO? Because also we wanted to share that knowledge with others. So the podcast was born, and this is how the kind of it kind of ballooned from there. And now, like, I'm solo hosting it, but it had some really, really amazing guests that I think have provided so many great insights. Like, I had like Jason Fried, we had Camille Fournier on the show, Adriana Tan, like a whole bunch of amazing folks. And through that, I think I learned more than I expected, just because like it was a very serendipitous kind of like start a podcast and then find out. And then I actually used a lot of the insights in my own career and my own work.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I like talking about career stuff off and on the show. We kind of do these discussions, and I came to programming back to programming very late. I always, people are like, you're a broken record talking about this, but it's like, 10 years ago, I decided, I want to get back into this. And I started with, SQL and stuff like that. And eventually got into Python and learned lots of other kind of languages as you go. But yeah, that kind of finding your path and like learning how to navigate just corporations in general was a thing for me. Like I was living in Hawaii and I was working in banking, and I'm like, why is everybody just going across the street to, the three different banks that were in downtown Honolulu, and kind of what's going on. And, that was not even just, that was just finance and banking. But as far as the tech part was the same, it's just everybody got to figure out how you're going to navigate and move around. So that's nice to have a conversation spot for it.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, again, it mostly was for like self learning, right? Because you learn by doing.
Yeah.
And that was a way to connect with those people, because otherwise, like if you just reach out randomly to somebody on LinkedIn and ask for advice, nobody's going to do that. But when you ask them to come on a podcast, it's a whole different conversation.
Right. And they have a document for themselves also, a way of promoting what they do. And
yeah,
cool.
Works both ways. I like to think so. Yeah. But it's been like, we're running it for like 5 years now. So going on six. So
yeah, yeah.
Kind of nice.
The same boat. 2020 started at the same time.
We're like the podcast twins. There.
Yeah, totally. So speaking of that, you have a recent career move. You were working for Microsoft. I actually looked at your blog post about leaving Microsoft, and I guess that was like a kind of a third tour at Microsoft.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And now you're working for Anthropic, which is amazing because they're doing amazing work, and I've been impressed by everything they're doing there. And you want to talk a little bit about that, about the transition?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So as you called out, this was my third tour of duty at Microsoft at this point, right?
Yeah.
I joined at Microsoft when I first started my career. Then I left to go to AWS, worked a little bit there, came back to Microsoft, left, went to work at Netlify, then left, came back to Microsoft to work on security. And then the last year, I've actually been immersed a lot in the core AI division, which was responsible for, like the GitHub Copilot and integration with AI with developer tools and kind of the agentic ecosystem. And through that work, I got involved in this project that we might know. It's called Model Context Protocol, or MCP. It's an open source protocol that the industry broadly adopted to help connect AI systems to real data and applications. And we can talk about that more. But
yeah.
Where I got involved is specifically in kind of the auth and security space, because I worked on that before Core AI at Microsoft. So naturally, when MCP was coming online for the very first time,
you brought all those questions with you.
Yeah. Like I looked at the specification. I was like, this sounds really cool. Like I can totally see the potential. I understand why this is valuable. And I see some potential gaps for authorization spec. You folks did not really mention this thing here. Or what about this thing here? And then basically I just asked, is it okay if I take a stab at rewriting the authorization spec just a little bit and make sure that I adjust it to add these the modern auth pieces? And I was told, yeah, sure. Go ahead and do this. It's an open source project. So I kind of started from there, started contributing, started getting feedback from the community, and that led to basically the first spec rewrite of the authorization piece.
Okay.
Right. So again, I'm not by any stretch claiming credit for myself. This is a massive community effort. We had folks from Okta and Amazon and Anthropic that were working on that together with us. So that happened. And then through those contributions, I got basically invited as one of the steering committee members, like a core maintainer is what they call.
Okay.
And with that, I started kind of contributing more to kind of, again, the auth and security space, because this is where I was focused on. And as time went on, I was spending just so much time, just even my free time that I had after work. It's I just want to go and do these MCP things. I want to build the sample. I want to document this thing. And that naturally led me to where I am now, which is Anthropic, where I work on MCP. And this kind of was a very, I'm going to say like a serendipitous but natural progression, that the stuff that I've done before, I just do it on Anthropic now. That's all changed.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been documenting a lot of it over the last year. You know, it's kind of wild to watch this whole transformation of the conversation, if you will, like, okay, how can we connect things together and the development of the protocol. And I'd like to actually talk a little bit about MCP. Just maybe we could start, yeah. You did a little bit of an explainer, like kind of a sentence there. Maybe we could go a little deeper. And then I also would like to think about like, how's that definition changing?
Yeah. So MCP stands for Model Context Protocol. And for folks that are not yet kind of in the ecosystem and the ever-changing daily update to the AI landscape, the best way to explain it is something that I will totally steal from my friend James Montemagno. And when he explains it, he says, it's a protocol for providing context to models. So you just kind of flip the acronym back.
Flipped into words.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. It's a protocol for providing context to models because modern models are very, very capable. They're very powerful because they're trained on a lot of content. But the content is generally snapped to a specific time frame, right? Like you might have a model that's been trained in 2024.
Okay.
If I want to use that model to then go and write me, you know, a code snippet that uses a modern version of, let's say, React that got launched a week ago, like it's not going to know, right? Because like short of you pointing it somehow. So
right.
With MCP, I can now essentially embed natural ways of connecting to, let's say, documentation or other applications or other apps that provide code snippets, or like it can be really anything. This is especially important if you live in the world of like enterprises where you want to operate on data.
Sure.
Right? Data that lives in SharePoint or Dropbox or Box or Salesforce or any of those services. And like just typically, if you would ask the models, like, what are my sales projections for the next year? It doesn't know. It doesn't understand like what data am I going to even use for that. So MCP provides those universal hooks,
okay,
by which you can essentially have the model do tool calling or use any other primitives by basically saying like, oh, let me go to Salesforce and get your data and then bring it back in. Let me go to SharePoint and bring your latest Excel spreadsheet that does X, Y, and Z tracking, and we're going to pull it into the context and then operate on that context, right? So far, for the past, again, the protocol is also, by the way, very, very young. People think MCP is this like magical thing that it only existed for like a year.
It's like November 2024.
Yeah, exactly. It's like just a little bit more than a year. But so when MCP first started, also was very much text only.
Yes. Right?
You would interact with the model. It would get the data from some app. It'd put the text back into your chat context and then you operate on that. So that was all fine and dandy. But we also quickly realized that there is a new opportunity here. And this is where Liad Yosef and Ido Solomon were working on this project called MCP UI. And the idea was like, well, can we just make this a little bit more content rich or context rich, if you will? Because if I am trying to book a vacation and I'm using an AI agent like Claude to go and ask, like, I want to book a vacation in XYZ location. Like you mentioned Hawaii. Maybe I want to go to Hawaii.
Sure.
I want to book a flight. I want to see the hotels. And maybe I want to also look for some like tourist attractions. I want to go and, I don't know, hike to Mauna Kea and I need a car rental that I can actually take up the mountain. How do I do that? So do I do this just by text? Do I do just by like typing back and forth and be like, oh yeah, I want a car in this? Or do I just say, I need a flight, car, hotel, and some destinations? And in that case,
check boxes.
Right, like you end up with a lot of the MCP UI that is now basically MCP apps. That's what we call it. MCP app, okay, is a super powerful concept that allows you to embed basically these visual web-based UI experiences that say, oh, you need to book a flight? Let me go to, I don't know, I'm going to use a random travel service like Expedia, or maybe you're booking direct,
sure,
and pull the flight information and render it for you the way that that vendor wanted to render it, to show you like all flight information, when it departs, the times and all the details. So I don't have to read a text table. I see this visually. Same for cars, right? Like I'm trying to book a car. if I want to go up to Mauna Kea, I probably need a Jeep. I need a 4x4.
Right.
Okay, like, show me those cars. Don't explain to me. It's like, oh, there's also a Hyundai Sonata. And it's like, I don't necessarily know. Like,
what's that look like? Sonata, SUV? What is that?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Like, I don't know what car model is. But instead, I can get a view from, again, the same vendor. It says, here's available cars. Like, pick a car. And I can say, oh, great, yes, this is the one that I want. So it provides you that interactivity right where you are operating with that agent, which makes it a lot easier to provide these, I want to say, like, more natural experiences that you as a human would expect, right? Because I'm taking a specific action. I want that action to be as straightforward as possible. Reduce the mental load. The whole point of a lot of these AI systems is help me reduce the toil. And for me, if I would have to, like, let me review this table of 15 cars that I can use to book. It's like, okay, it's toilet. Now I need to go and look. It's like, is this car big enough for my family? Are all the kids going to fit? Like, it's a lot of work. With MCP apps, now MCP is basically extended to also allow MCP servers to return UI inside your chat interfaces. And this is already supported with Claude. It is supported with, like, if you've seen the demos, like VS Code is another client that supports this. And we're working with a bunch of other client providers as well to make sure that this becomes kind of the standard for a lot of these capabilities with other folks at other companies and client implementers as well.
A quick word from our sponsor, Agent Field. Most developers still think of AI as chatbots, but move agents into the back end and something wild happens. Agents running simulations to optimize pricing, orchestrating logistics across warehouses and carriers, triaging security incidents automatically, resolving insurance claims end-to-end. Not a human using chatbot, but autonomous software. This requires real infrastructure, identity, authorization, and scale. Agent Field is an open-source framework for building backends that reason, like APIs and microservices, but intelligent. No DAGs, no rigid pipelines. They're defining a new category, the AI backend. Search Agent Field on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. I have like three things I want to hit on inside of that. One is the idea of providing context. One of the conversations I've had a while ago was with Kyle Stratus. It was episode 266. We talked about the dangers of automatically converting REST APIs into MCP. And the idea there of just, these are all the endpoints that you can hit and just make them all be MCP, which doesn't really make sense. And it's kind of like confusing to do. It should be much more structured and have a lot better planning. Like, people can listen to that conversation there. But I provided an analogy to him. I said, so it's a little bit like jacking into the matrix. It's like giving your client system a way to say, oh, now I know how to do, you know, whatever it is, you know, the financial services, you know, whatever site. Now I understand how to talk that language. You know, now I know Kung Fu or whatever.
Exactly.
And so that is the context that we're talking about. This is providing all of the sort of rules and pathways that are normal types of verbs and maybe nouns that this system would then talk through.
Right.
Is that a good explanation of it?
Yeah, I think so. Because the mistake that I always see people do when they are first new to MCP, and especially in, again, enterprise scenarios, like, oh, we have this API with 300 endpoints. Now every single endpoint is an MCP tool.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, no, like, don't do that. Like, you have to focus on specific scenarios, right?
Right.
In our example about like travel booking, workflow, like, I probably need an API for list flights. I need an API for list hotels, list car available or something. And then obviously for those, I need a, you know, book flight, book hotel, book car.
Right.
Right. You just have six tools that basically do the core of what you're trying to accomplish and what are the scenarios. Like, I don't need some other API that checks, like, you know, like, check flight compliance with like whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. Right. Like, expose me one tool.
Or developer stuff that it would be like for like removing content or doing other things that you're like, you don't want people touching.
It's exactly that. You have to basically minimize it to the minimal set of valuable things that your customers will do.
Okay.
That's how it needs to be exposed through the MCP server, because also you're going to be running into scenarios where some clients, for example, don't do tool filtering. So you end up with like 300 different tools from all the MCP servers, and you're like
filling your context.
You're overloading your context at that point. So you have to make sure that as you design MCP servers, you're also very intentional about what you're exposing and why.
Okay. One of the most common demonstration of uses of these tools by, let's say, larger corporate entities is, okay, I'm going to just ask this thing to just book all that stuff for me.
Yeah.
And just, it should just return in my chat system and, you know, pay the money and so forth and message all my friends and, hey, we've booked this house on Airbnb and we've set up your flights and so forth. And I can personally see that as being rather problematic, and there's lots of questions that would happen to it. So the idea that no, there should be some back and forth about, like, you know, should I make this decision and so forth. And it just being chat, I agree, is kind of clunky, especially for something like a vacation. Well, I'd like to look at the house. I'd like to see where it is and things like that. And the UI stuff, I think, is really, really cool. I was amazed by that when I literally was discovering it, you know, before our conversation here. I saw your video, and I'll share it with, you know, in the show notes here. The MCP will never be the same render UI with MCP apps, your YouTube video, which is really nice. And I enjoyed that a lot. But that's kind of the idea there, that it's still, you're talking to this assistant, if you will, in this case, and it's in a bit of a chat, and it's now able to now bring up visual elements of things, UI elements, or potentially allowing you to have a drop-down menu of choices or things like that. Like, it can provide you with something a little more elegant than just pure text. Everybody thinks it's all going to go to just speaking things, but often, you know, the person using it isn't familiar with what even they should be asking.
Right.
And UI provides so much of that.
It fosters a kind of exploration of certain things. And I know for myself, I'm a very visual person. So I want to be able to see things. Like, don't make me read 7 paragraphs of text. Like, I will read that when I need to.
Right.
But if I don't have to, like, I'm planning a vacation, like, make it easier for me. Make it more convenient. Like, remove toil from my life.
Yeah.
I'm all about removing toil from my life. And this is one example where so many capabilities can now just be simplified, really simplified, because just render the UI. Don't explain it to me over text. Just render the UI.
How new is this? I feel like this is like weeks, maybe a month.
I mean, MCP apps itself has been in the works since at least November, right? Like, we're also partnering with the awesome folks at OpenAI, who have been building the apps SDK, right? So they have had that capability as well. This is essentially an incarnation of a lot of the lessons learned in the universal way, right? So it's a open source standard that's available to anyone, that's available to any client, any host that wants to use this, and it adopts a lot of these patterns. Now, the things that you do inside the MCP app itself, a lot of this is very similar to web development. Like, it's not going to be any different than what you've done before. It's just now built on top of the MCP abstractions, right? So if you've built web apps before, you build web interfaces, congratulations, you are ready to build MCP apps.
Yeah, it seems like there's, like, you know, the 7 flavors of JavaScript presentation layers that you can pick and choose from. Thankfully, there's like a vanilla kind of version in there in case you don't want to go too deep.
Right.
And I wondered about that a little bit, like, if somebody wanted to stay within Python within that, I'm guessing that's something that would probably develop as it goes. There are some UI systems and ways of rendering it. There's this weird intermingling of hosting apps, Python apps on the web now.
Well, I think there's a difference kind of at what layer Python would be there, right? Because for us, like, we're exploring how to expose this capability through, like, other MCP SDKs, including the Python SDK, right? Because as I mentioned just now, a lot of these abstractions are built on top of the MCP server itself exposing specific transport primitives, right? But beyond that is just HTML and JavaScript. So, like, does anything prevent you from having a Python-based MCP server, like, feeding that UI as HTML? Absolutely not. Like, no. Like, there's no reason for that to be the case. It just happened to be that we started this with the TypeScript version.
Yeah.
But we're exploring this coming to, again, Python, other SDKs like the C# SDK, Go SDK, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And I'll include links for, you know, obviously the video, but then the GitHub for the app.
The app extension, right? All right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so people can kind of check out that and the examples that are in there that you can kind of learn to play with a bit. So the other thing along with that is in your demonstration there, you're building a color picker, which is an interesting use case, which I understand totally. Like, you know, I very do basic. A lot of graphical stuff and you know, you want it to look pretty and that's going to be important. And you're kind of building it as a tool that's sort of a developer tool to continue to use in your, I don't know, I hate using the word agentic workflow or whatever, but it's within the tools that you're already using.
Yeah.
If I'm explaining that right. And then on top of that, building that tool, you had to make it sort of available to all your other systems. And you used a system through Cloudflare, which I was not familiar with. I've never played with Cloudflare D. And maybe you could just explain that a little bit further. Maybe this is an add-on to your YouTube video.
Yeah, there's going to be something that I probably have to explain separately. But basically, I'm a big fan of Cloudflare. The fantastic work from those folks that are doing a lot of the cloud ecosystem stuff. But one of the things that they actually did is enable this feature called tunnels.
Okay.
So when you build MCP servers, and especially when you build MCP servers that are, like, there's two classes of them. There's remote and local. Local MCP servers are basically local applications. Like I can build a Python MCP server and then do a UV and just run it locally and just connect it to my client, which is fine.
So those tools are available right there.
It's just a local app. Like at that point, it can be Python. It can be a binary written in whatever language you want.
Okay.
But there is a good degree of flexibility that comes with making your server remotely available. So a lot of developers built remote MCP server. That means they host it somewhere, it gets a URL, the user can then go and log in with their credentials and the server gets that context and can operate on a lot of cloud data and so on and so forth. But if you're building it locally first and then you need to expose it as a remote server, well, that's kind of a complicated problem now because like if your MCP client, and especially if you're using a cloud-based MCP client like Claude.ai, I can't connect it to localhost, right? Like I can't because like it runs in a cloud that has no awareness of localhost. It's not on my local network. So to bypass that, we need to somehow basically expose the localhost to the public internet.
Okay.
Right. And when I say the public internet is because for testing and development in my samples, they're not that important. I can expose it to the public internet. There's a lot of capabilities you can expose this to just your internal network. Like you don't need to actually make it public to everyone.
Okay.
So, but long story longer, Cloudflare D, and specifically with the ability to add tunnels, allowed me to expose my localhost server to, well, a tunnel that then through Cloudflare gets a URL. It's a regular HTTPS URL that I can just plug in into Cloud.ai and work with it as if it's a remote server. Right.
Okay.
These tools have existed, by the way, for a while. Like it's not new. Like Cloudflare Tunnels is that. And Grok is another product that does kind of something similar where you can essentially expose local content through basically like a reverse proxy. So you have these capabilities out there and they make the integration and the developer experience much simpler because I don't have to worry about like, oh, let me go and open up a port in my router and hopefully not get hacked or like, oh, now I need to go set up like tail scale and expose it, which is like, yeah, you can do this. It's just a bit of a hassle. And Cloudflare D and specifically with the tunnel capability was just a simpler way to do that.
Plus it's
free.
You're in development mode. It's not like deployment at this point.
Right. It makes it much. Also, that's a very good point actually, because typically now I could say that I have a staging environment somewhere like,
okay.
So I have to build it, run it through CI. It's going to deploy it. So like it's a process. It's a slower process, but it is possible. Companies do it all the time. But for something that like quick and dirty, I just need like, can I just expose this right now as a URL and quickly test it and see like, does this even work? Like before I even push it to the repo, that is a fantastic tool that allows me to reduce the time of just dealing with a lot of these complexities. And then if it doesn't work, I just start rewriting code. And while the tunnel is alive and my app is running, like I don't need to refresh it. I don't need to redeploy it. It's just there. So super easy.
Yeah. And it would remain connected through that tunnel, you know, for as long as you want. And then you can just end that session.
Yeah. I'm sure Kloffner probably has some like reasonable, you know, if your tunnel is running for like 3 weeks or something, like, I don't know if they
question it.
Maybe they'll shut it down or like, I don't know, maybe the connection terminates. Like, I haven't actually pushed it to the limit, but
okay,
I've used it for dev work for like servers running for like an hour or so. And like, it's totally fine.
Okay. There is a lot of that idea of like, I'm going to build and do development locally, even though, you know, MCP is somewhat designed for this sort of, you know, expanded connectivity across the internet and so forth. Are there techniques for doing that as far as like, you know, building your local servers and things like that you need to pay attention to that, or advice you can share?
Yeah, well, I think it depends on what you're building an MCP server for, right? Because there are certain things, and again, as I mentioned, that there's the local MCP servers and the remote MCP servers. There is certain class of problems where you absolutely need a local MCP server.
Okay.
Like, I'll give you one example. I'm big into reverse engineering. There is this tool released by NSA called Ghidra.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of that? It's literally called Ghidra, and it is used for reverse engineering binary content. Mm. And
it's from the, you know, the actual NSA.
Yeah. It's built by the actual NSA.
Yeah.
It's a really cool tool though. And so if you're in kind of the reverse engineering mode and you've used this tool before, you know that it's very like, it's not the most intuitive. Mm. Right. So, and it can take time. So somebody in the community built this project called Ghidra MCP.
Okay.
And it literally connects basically as a plugin to Ghidra, and it allows you to just use the LLM to control the reverse engineering process. Mm. Like you ask it to do things, right? So it removes toil for me. Now that MCP server cannot be done remotely because you just like, it's a local application running on my box. How are you going to control it, right? So the local MCP server essentially is controlling the local application. There's another example of that, which is Blender MCP. Like, have you ever used Blender like for 3D modeling?
Yeah, I attempted to use it to make 3D printed models and that didn't work out great, but...
you know, it's complicated, right? Like super like, again, like if you're somebody that uses Blender a lot, I'm sure you already have the muscle memory, you know how it works.
Right.
For somebody new, it was very unintuitive. So there's a Blender MCP that you can connect to your local application and then through the LLM go and say, I'm trying to build this like medieval scene with a fireplace. And then it just goes and like starts iterating on the like the polygons and everything. It's just kind of freaking cool. Like,
very cool.
Because all of a sudden it removes the toil for me. Like I still want to learn the tool, but I still want to see like, oh, how would you create a polygon? How would you like position it? How would you set up the scene? How do you set up the lighting and all that stuff? Yeah. Right.
So it's so easier to modify things that exist and learn by touching them as opposed to like, well, I don't even have a cube yet.
Yeah, exactly. Because then once I see the sphere somewhere, I see the fire, like, okay, let me go. Okay, now I see this is like five polygons. How do I add a polygon? How do
alter
I like,
it?
Yeah. Alter it? 100% agree. Like much easier to iterate on it once somebody does the scaffolding for you. So for those tools, like a local MCP server is super, super helpful because I don't need to host it anywhere. It's just a local binary. It can be written in Python that just basically controls this application. It still exposes a set of tools that says create polygon, and the create polygon has to somehow exist and be exposed by Blender, right? So this is just like it's a layer of abstraction over another application. So super helpful. And then there's remote MCP servers that, you know, like I am connecting to my Dropbox file store to be able to get the latest, you know, five podcast episodes that we recorded and generate a transcript for. Can you go and get those files for me?
Sure.
And if I have the Dropbox MCP, you can just do that, pull the files and then use another. Maybe I'm using Whisper MCP to go and transcribe that with my local Whisper model, right? So you start kind of assembling that. That's actually one of the underrated capabilities of MCP is that composability.
Yeah.
Is that it's not just you are using one MCP server for specific tasks. It's just once you have several of them connected, they can interoperate with each other. My task for this year is for my podcast, I want to productize the entire workflow of editing and recording and everything else. And I'm thinking that MCP is going to be the way to do that because I can essentially build an MCP server for like, hey, we record the stuff in Zencastr. Can you go and grab the files from Zencastr or Google Drive or wherever you store it and then pull them locally for this episode, generate transcript, find me the most interesting parts of our conversation that, right. you know, like three highlights.
That's a common thing now. Yeah.
Like go, now there's going to be an MCP server for maybe like, I don't know, DaVinci that's going to like cut the video at those time slices where we're the most interesting in and then produce me the MP4 with the FFmpeg MCP server or just call FFmpeg CLI because the models are really good at that as well. And just, right, like, remove the toil from me. Like, my interesting part about this podcast is talking to you, right? Like, this to me is, right. this is the fun part. This is like, we're having, like, this conversation.
Right. You don't want to become a video editor in your yeah. later part of your life here.
After this, like, after we're done, you're like, oh, man, now I have to, like, cut, remove all the, and think, like, all these things, right? Like, it's toil. It is really toil. And some people appreciate kind of the process of it, which is fine. But to me,
right.
I want to remove as much of this toil as possible so I can focus on preparing for a conversation. So I can focus on making sure that I'm paying attention to you right now and not focusing on like, is my file going to be recorded in the right format? And is the transcript generating? Like just, right, I'll right. worry about that later.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess part of it that I haven't had a chance to play with as much is that connection between these multiple things. Like, how are you, if you will, snapping them together? What does that look like as far as like an environment and saying like...
Yeah. Inside a MCP client, and I say MCP client, it's a bad way to describe it. It's basically like any of the modern clients are by default MCP clients because they almost okay. all of them support MCP.
So this would be like Claude Code, this would be like what have you.
Claude Code, Claude AI, like, you know, ChatGPT supports MCP servers, VS Code does, like,
okay.
you know, a bunch of other products. So... the goal here is basically you're taking these MCP servers that are relevant to your scenarios and you just connect them.
Okay.
That's all. Because once you start going through a specific scenario through whatever LLM you're using,
yeah.
if it supports tool calling, it can actually go and identify the tool for the scenario. So if you were talking about like planning a vacation,
right.
and it's like, oh, cool. Let me go and see like what I need for vacation. I need flights, hotel, car.
Right.
Great. Do I have... oh, I have a tool here that allows us like book flight. Let me use that. And, you know, it's going to render this up. And then after that, it's going to invoke the next tool, which is probably like, oh, do you have a tool for hotels or oh, yeah, I have an Airbnb MCP server. Let me use that.
Okay.
So you go through like a lot of the stuff becomes driven by the model itself, less so than by you directing it at like, and now get me the car and now get me this, right? Like it's much more natural.
One of the things that's been brought up, I listen to the Vergecast pretty often, and the hosts on that show often say the problem here is where do the people make money from exposing all of these tools in the end? Like, is there going to be a fee that they pay to use this particular thing? Like, a lot of the development, you're maybe potentially stealing eyeballs from them, an actual consumer going to their website, and they usually would monetize by having additional advertisements on it or other things like that potentially. Is that something that you hear people talking about when they're creating these things, like figuring out like, well, how can we make money on this? Some of the things that we've talked about, you know, like Blender or whatever, that's an open source tool, and a variety of the different things are sort of experimenting with this. But I kind of wonder about the financial model sometimes behind it, like that would lead to like this larger success. So much of what we talk about is about programmers. And I feel like that stuff is amazing. Like what is happening with, you know, AI and LLMs and agentic stuff is
yeah.
really blowing my mind in the last several years. But then I kind of wonder about like, okay, well, how does this translate? And I don't know, is that stuff that you think about or you hear people conversing about?
This is something that I'll caveat by saying that this is my personal opinion on this.
Sure.
This is not, I'm not speaking for anybody else here, but I hear this concern every once in a while, but I generally think that this concern might be a little bit misplaced because,
okay,
of course, there's room for like premium MCP server. Maybe you have an MCP server that is capable of like, I don't know, a local application doing something really magical with your files or whatever, and you want to charge people for it, and that's fine. You can... just like any other software, you're totally entitled to go and charge right. people a premium for that. If you have a remote MCP server that does something magical or solves a problem, just as well. You can gate it behind an auth wall. You can't use it until you log in. And you can only log in if you have a paid account, right? Like that's simple. I think for a lot of other services, like we're kind of leaning on our vacation example, right? Like
we have been, yeah.
If I'm booking a vacation, I already want to give you money.
Sure.
Like, I'm looking for a hotel, right? Like, why does it matter if I go to the website or I just go through my LLM and say, like, I want to book a hotel and like this service is going to list me the hotels and I'll book a hotel through that.
Okay.
Like, I'm giving you money either way, right?
Right.
Same for like, I need to go and find a restaurant with some, you know, Yelp or whatever other review place, right? Like, I'm already looking at giving you money for something. Just take the money in a different context. The analogy that I've heard about this is like, if you have websites that do this, and then we have our phones,
yes,
where we have apps for them. Do they refuse to build apps? Because like, no, we want you to go to the website and see everything there and then pay us, like, or you just use the app because that's what people right. already have. I have my phone, just give me the app to do this. So the same would apply here. Like, do you have to necessarily like expose this through an MCP server and make sure that people have to like, you know, point them to a website? Like, you could go either way, right? But there's a lot of value in going where the customers are. So if I'm yes. already operating in the context of a chat client that works with an AI agent and I'm trying to book a hotel, why not just let me book a hotel right there and simplify the process for me, the customer, then say, no, you can't book it here. Go to our website to book the hotel. It's like, that's a terrible experience.
Right.
And like, again, putting myself in the shoes of like Den, the customer, I want to reduce toil, as I mentioned. Like, I do not want to be clicking on 7 different websites and booking. Like, I want everything to be in one place. And I'm paying for this either way. Like, I'm planning a vacation. I'm right. planning to give you the money. Just let me do that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. Like, there's been a lot of that, what do you want to call it, migration movement. You know, it was websites, then it was apps, right. and now it's kind of back to websites. And now it's kind of like this new model of way of operating that, you know, I think the idea of it kind of wrapping everything together, like, I think the tools themselves sort of exposing their own yeah. pieces, I think kind of is the unique thing here.
Yeah.
But the UI thing is really making a big difference. I think will be pretty large there.
100%. It's all contextual, right? Like, I don't want to be overly prescriptive of what people should do because, you know, like, I don't know every single scenario. I don't know every single edge case. And there's right. absolutely scenarios where I can envision that maybe the UI inside your like chat interface is not the right place for what you're trying to do. And you have to send people to the website because that's where that experience shines. And that's totally fair. But there's a lot of scenarios that can absolutely be done in a way that you still control that experience. You still can build that UI the way you want it to be, right? The concern around like, oh, well, are we giving up control of our experience to somebody else? Like, no, you're still in charge of your experience. You still build it the way that makes sense for your company, for your project, for your SaaS startup. It just is shown in a different context.
Yeah.
Again, the app store analogy comes to mind. Like, you have the website, the web experience, and then you have the app on your phone that has a slightly different way of visualizing the same context, but you're going where the customers are. And I'm a big believer in going where your customers are.
Yeah. Where do they want to go?
Yeah.
What do they want to use?
Yeah. Help them where they are.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's about using Gemini CLI to bring Google's AI-powered coding assistance directly into your terminal. The course is titled Getting Started with Google Gemini CLI, and it's presented by Philip Ixeni. Philip takes you through installing Gemini CLI, authenticating with your Google account, analyzing code, identifying bugs, requesting a code quality analysis, and prompting for suggested fixes, all while working in your familiar terminal. Whether you're troubleshooting bugs, working to understand legacy code, or generating documentation, this course will get you up and running with Google Gemini CLI. And like most of the video courses on RealPython, the course is broken into easily consumable sections. Each lesson includes a transcript, including closed captions, and where needed, you'll have access to code samples for the technique shown. Check out the video course. You can find a link in this episode's show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. The other part of the conversation I wanted to get into with you is another recent development. I mean, along with all the LLM coding, which is maybe I don't know, 2 to 3 years old. Recent developments, I had Mark Brooker on to talk about spec-driven development. You know, he's coming from the AWS side with his tools of Kiro.
Yeah.
And I was not that familiar with the GitHub sort of flavor of that, which you had a lot of work with, SpecKit.
Yes.
And I'm intrigued by this in a lot of ways. Like one of the conversations I had with Christopher Trudeau was an article about, gosh, aren't we just going back to waterfall? And it's like, okay, I'm not sure if I understand what you mean by that. This idea that everything has to be written out and designed before we build it. I think it's kind of coming from a different angle, this idea of maybe as you develop these tools, maybe we should keep some of that context written down,
yeah,
and not repeat things. And so I don't know, like, what is your opinion on this and like what's been your experience in this world of like building specs? And then we can kind of maybe translate that into Anthropic's recent stuff with skills.
Yeah. So I think just generally when we look at specs, it's not anything, you know, super mind-blowingly complicated.
Right.
Like people attribute, like even SpecKit as a project, they're like, oh, like this new thing that just is blowing up. And it's like, you realize it's just a bunch of prompts and scripts. Like if you look at the repo, like it's not like it's anything more complicated than that. The whole idea is that when you're operating on a specific project, whether it's an existing project or a new project, you want to make sure that as much context is reusable and not left to guesswork. Right?
Right.
Because if I am building an application that does X, Y, and Z scenario, my job is to solve those scenarios. To make sure that those scenarios are solved, I want to make sure that the model doesn't guess, right?
Yes, like,
doesn't assume.
Because it likes to do that.
Yeah, because a lot of the models nowadays are over-eager. They will go and say like, eagerness, you're trying to build a website for your blog? Let me add all these like 17 different pages. I'm going to start make sure that there's previews, which is like, okay, that's fine. But oftentimes you have very constrained scenarios. So how do you put those constraints in place? You spec it. That you literally say, I want you to do this. You fail if you do these.
Yeah.
That's what SpecKit was. And I think that when we talk about like spec-driven development, it's basically at its core, it's a way to manage context and memory. That's kind of all, that's all it is.
Yes.
Right? Whether you use SpecKit or any other tool, I personally actually like after SpecKit, I start even simplifying that by just having like one markdown file that just like just dump everything in there. And as the model iterates, and sometimes it has to find little nuggets of knowledge. I'll give you a very concrete example that I've actually been doing recently. So,
okay,
I am a fan of the Halo series of games.
I was going to bring this up because my wife and I played that together quite a bit.
There you go. And as part of that, what I'm doing right now is after every Halo match and Halo Infinite, the latest edition of this,
okay,
you get a set of what's known as film files, but they're not really film files. They're just binary files used for reconstruction by the game engine. So when you decide to replay, like, oh, what did I do in that match? It feeds these binary files.
It's like a full-on narrative.
Yeah, like here's the area of the map and positions and the gravity settings and everything, but it's a binary file. It's a very opaque binary blob that I have no idea about, right?
Right.
So what I do is I essentially use Opus 4.5 with Cloud Code to go like, I will reverse engineer this. I don't want to tinker with every byte iteration by myself. I'll just have Opus do this for me. And to do that, I have to basically, because there's a lot of binary content, I can't just expect it to go like, go find me everything you know about this file. Like it has no context.
Right.
I have some context. So I'm going to spec this out and I say, okay, you have to look at like, this chunk does this. This chunk has a header somewhere. This chunk is structured this way, but I don't necessarily know what the binary structure is.
Right.
And so Opus, and especially if you put in this, have you ever heard of this Ralph loop?
No, that sounds cool.
Ralph from The Simpsons, like you know how like you always fail, but you keep persisting until you succeed.
Okay.
So with Cloud Code, there's a plugin. It's called literally Ralph loop, where you can put it to work. And basically, like, even if it fails, it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to try a different approach. Oh, this failed. I'm going to try a different approach. So you put this in a loop of iteration, basically.
Okay.
And this is what I've been using for this project, where I was essentially putting in a loop of iterating. It's like, okay, I gave you like a control set of matches. Go find X, Y, and Z, because I know the data is in there. I don't know where. Go and compare these files. So it would go and churn on this and then be like, okay, I found these things. But as you know, context is limited, right? Like at some point,
sure.
If you've seen like in Claude Code or any other AI tool, like it says compacting. And compacting basically means like, okay, I reached the limit. Now I need to compress the context and continue iterating because my context window is filled up.
Is it kind of quantizing it in a way, like removing pieces of it?
Or? Yeah, I think it's more of like, let me just summarize what we did before.
Okay.
And because like, I don't have any more context, but I don't want to continue working. So the moment you reach that point, that means that context that you had from me parsing a bunch of binary content is lost. Well, not all of it, but like it's summarized. So now I need to have a way to, for the new chat, basically to rehydrate it with like, okay, by the way, we found 10 things that absolutely work.
Yeah.
Right?
Build from there. Don't start over.
Build from there. So then it goes to this markdown document where it's dumping everything. It's like, okay, let me take a look at what you already have. Like, oh, okay, you've analyzed this header. Okay, you've analyzed this. Okay, so you have the structure here and this is the binary offset that I can go and iterate on, right?
Okay.
So it'll like specs, and when we talk about spec driven development, it's essentially like encoding a lot of this context preemptively and making sure that the model can iterate. So then you build a feature for your app, you come back a week later, and then you're like, oh, right, we need to also add this other button here. What were the design choices that you made? What were the choices around like accessibility testing? What were the choices around unit testing, right? Yeah. And a lot of the specs just encode this context that the model can then pick up and use it to basically, it's rehydrating itself with that context and use it to drive new features, bug fixes, whatever you're building. So that's what it is. That's as complex as it gets, right? Like it's not as waterfall-y as people think. This is more of training you to be very explicit about your requirements and capturing the learnings and then making sure that you're guiding the model to the outcome that you want instead of letting the model guess, right? At its core, you're setting the guardrails to make sure that you remove guesswork. And by the way, this applies to humans too. Imagine you're working with a product manager, right? And you're like, okay,
right.
Look, Christopher, we're going to build a site that is going to be for our music store. And we're going to be tracking our, purchases, allow online purchases and, you know, as an online store does. Okay, good luck. Go build it. And you're like, okay, well, where do I start? Okay, we need a landing page.
How many different directions could I start in? Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'll put a search box here, maybe like a cart here. Like, okay, maybe I'll accept Visa and MasterCard. Right? Like, you start making assumptions because it's like, oh, okay, you gave me a scenario. When you write specs, like I can hand you a spec like, no, I want you to accept these payment methods, use Stripe for payments, use this, and then you eliminate the guesswork. It's exactly the same pattern here. Like we're not inventing anything new. Like this is basically like, can you provide clear requirements that I can operate on?
Yeah, there's a thing that happens with creativity that is similar.
Yeah.
If you are been giving limits and say you need to write a song and it has to be played on a classical guitar only. It needs to use these five chords. Like suddenly it frees you to actually start creating as opposed to like having, you know, all the world's possibilities. Well, I got like seven guitars. Which one should I use today? It's like, No. Like somebody like setting those kind of demands to you. And it's obviously, you know, these things are built on language and built on rules and built on systems that have existed.
Yeah, 100%. That's why my rebuttal to a lot of these things would be like, oh, like we're reinventing waterfall. Now we're adding all this like craft and like, okay, well, like, have you ever worked in a team where you had to write requirements down for somebody?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Now you need to just write requirements for AI. Like that's all it is.
Yeah. One of the things I wonder about that I've been hearing, you know, people on other shows, podcasts that I listen to, talk about their experience of trying these tools out and trying to learn how to code.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously they're learning as they go. And I feel like this would be useful, I feel.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, they go back to the code that's been written. And a computer is completely comfortable writing the same steps like 75 times. And it's like, oh no, that should be a function.
Yeah.
And we should probably not, you know, do that. Do you have advice to like how you can say in your prompting or other ways to say, or is that a separate step of like refactoring?
Yeah. I think this is where having experience in engineering really, really helps, because then you know what to expect, right? Because we see a lot of the vibe coding projects, and then you're like, oh, they have all these like security vulnerabilities. And you're like, oh, yeah, right. You had nobody from security actually review and understand this, right? And I think there's a good degree of, again, encode your requirements. If you, like, one of the things that I started doing after I kind of immersed myself in a lot of the spec-driven stuff, but then I kind of backed off a little bit. Again, I just, very simple now, it's just like one markdown file. But one thing that I really, really kind of stuck with me that is super helpful is using tests first.
Okay.
And having it write tests and then say, write a test for this function, this function, this function. These tests need to fail. So it fails, and then you're like, okay, now start implementing this functionality and make sure this test passes. Huh. And basically, then you're essentially setting it up for hill climbing where you give it the harness to go and iterate against. That's one. The other one is like, you going back to the requirements, just make sure that you document those requirements. Like some of the libraries that I've wrote, I knew that functionality between like the authorization component versus the token validation component versus the caching component, they should be separate libraries. So I would be very explicit about, make sure that you have separation of concerns and do not bundle everything in the library. Make sure that there's interfaces instead of just lumping everything in one class and exposing it through, you know, one single massive blob of text.
Okay.
A lot of these come from experience, of course. And
right.
Again, as engineers, like, we know how to define that. It's a little bit harder for somebody that's new to the industry because, again, you don't know what to look for. And I think this is where there's a good opportunity where I actually started using Claude in a very unique way, where not only do I have it write the code, like Claude code, I then go back and say, now explain to me, like, what were the decisions that you made? How did you design the modularity of this? Why is this area not having tests included? So it's not just I'm prompting it to go do the things for me. I okay. also want to learn myself. And then, for example, sometimes when you do this, the model they're using also will realize that, like, oh, right, I did not make this modular. Okay, here's why this is not modular, because this interface here doesn't quite work because we also have this like abstract class here and actually duplicated this functionality, right? So you're using it as a tool for learning, not just for as a tool for go and write me the code for me blindly and then I hope to get the outcome that I hope.
I think we hit most of the things I wanted to touch on about sort of thinking about spec-driven development, and maybe you can provide me some links to help people, you know, kind of learn a little more about MCP and
yeah.
Spec-driven development. If you got some nice tools there, we didn't touch on skills, but gosh, that probably could be a whole another conversation. I don't know if there's something we could talk about it briefly. I feel like it's an adaptation of these things, kind of coming from the Anthropic side.
Yeah. Yeah, skills are basically a lightweight way for you to guide your model to do certain things, right? Like, for certain things, you need an MCP server, like connecting to enterprise data. Other things, I'll give you an example where the skill is super useful. And we showed it with the MCP apps demo.
Yeah.
I want to create an MCP app, right? How do I actually explain to the model, like, how do you create an MCP app? Like, what are the components? What are the requirements? What's the framework? Well, you have a skill.
Okay.
And a skill is like, it's a markdown file with potentially is like some scripts attached to it. And it yeah. says, like, if you're creating an MCP, you can literally look inside of it. Like, it's a markdown file. And it'll tell you, like, an MCP app is an app that contains like this project structure and this library. And you have to have a package.json with these things. And it basically explains to the model, like, if you want to do this, here's how.
Yeah.
Right. That's all a skill is. It's just like a human skill, right? Like, if I want to have the skill of playing guitar,
right.
Explain to me, like, how do I play guitar? Like, you have to pick it up.
Hold your hand like this.
Here's how you hold it. Here's how you, like, strung the string. Like, all this stuff is basically encoded in text. And then when you come in to the model and say, now I want to create an app, you don't necessarily always look for an MCP server, MCP tool. You can also look at skills that exist locally.
Yeah.
You can have a skill for extracting data from a PDF file. You can have a skill for, I want to use FFmpeg to go and convert this video file that we have for our podcast into an audio file and sliced in like 30-second chunks or whatever you want, right? Like, I don't have to do this myself and explain it every single time that, like, oh, by the way, go in FFmpeg and use these command parameters here. Like, put in the skill, put it in the drawer, and you have it and you use it when it's there. It's also much more like token efficient in that regard because skills are only invoked when they're needed.
Okay.
And they're available. It's also an open source project. Like it's available in the Anthropic repo and GitHub. You can go there today and check it out and start using them. And I know that after Anthropic released skills, other folks have adopted this as well. So you can use skills with other clients like VS Code as well, or
they're using the same name and the same style.
It's the structure is the same because I think what actually I really like in the modern kind of AI era is that we have a lot of these like very natural standards emerging, right? You have like skills, MCP, you have agents.md, which like is kind of the universal guideline for agents. So
that's the oldest one, right? I think.
Yeah, I think so. Like I haven't. Time is a blur. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know about you, but like, it feels like, I don't know. Was it a week ago or a year ago? Either of one of those is probably the right answer. But it's like you can use any of those tools in your workloads. And again, it's not you have to be very discerning as to what is needed when.
Yeah.
But the tools are there. You have skills, you have MCP servers, you have agent instructions, you have context management, you know, life hacks where you can use like markdown files or any other content. Yeah. Bunch of work.
Yeah. And I want to gloss over that idea that the skills have one slightly unique thing that it can have pieces of scripts inside of it, code that, hey, don't repeat this code.
Right.
You know, like you can actually, you know, use what's here in the skill. This works. I've tested it and so forth. And again, that idea of maybe, I forget the term that you had used, removing some of the toiling.
Yes. Exactly. Because if I want to convert a video with FFmpeg, why do I have to like re-explain every single time how the CLI works for FFmpeg? Because it's a powerful tool, but it has like more commands than any programming language, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like I don't want to if I want to go convert the video, I never want to go to the model to start kind of like, oh, let me go and research FFmpeg. Oh, these perhaps. Oh, right. Let me try this. Oh, this didn't
How work. Many tokens later?
Just give me the very concrete thing that like, this is what I'm trying to do. It's also very lightweight, which I really like about this is that I can always tweak it. Like if I see like, oh, nope, that didn't work. I need to rewrite the script a little bit. Cloud Code, I have an issue here. Go and build this out.
Yeah.
Right. I've built like a myriad of skills for myself just for productivity gains because like I want like how do I build a Mozilla Thunderbird extension from a script file, like, oh, here you go, here's a skill for that, like trigger with like / rebuild it,
right? And those might be another thing you might want to build again, hence why it's nice to save these things. That was another thing that came up in my conversation, that so much of the, you know, the idea of having repositories, you know, the idea of like having code that's out there, but now this idea of like the specs, the skills, the what have you, you can pull that in and use that within your own stuff. So we're not all rewriting the wheel or rebuilding everything exactly the same every time.
Yep. I'm trying to avoid that as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're about efficiency, though. So we're programming, right?
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Like we write libraries.
Right.
Because like I don't want to reinvent OAuth every single time I create a new project.
Yeah.
Same with skills. Like, I don't want to reteach it how to read PDFs if I already have a workflow in my mind.
Yeah. Well, Dan, I have these questions I like to ask everybody who comes on the show.
Totally.
And the first one is, what are you excited about in the world of Python right now?
I will selfishly promote FastMCP.
Okay.
Because I think FastMCP have done just like such an amazing job of building this Python idiomatic set of abstractions over MCP that is just a delight to use. So I'm a big fan. So what I'm excited about in the world of FastMCP, the second one I'm excited is actually UV.
Yeah.
The folks at Astral are like, again, phenomenal. And just the amount of work that they've done in making this so performant. Like if I use UV, it just, again, it makes it a delight to install packages and manage packages and environments that I have previously had a lot of trouble with. Those two, FastMCP and UV.
That's great. What's something that you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be about programming. It can be what have you.
I always aspire to be a better reverse engineer.
Okay.
Like to me, I we talked about this a little bit on the show. But
you've been working on those skills.
I really, really want to get better at developing that, like the spidey sense of like know where to look and what to look for. Because right now, I try to, like, I've done this before. And I'm trying to leverage a lot of these models that we have now, the powerful models like Opus 4.5, to go and explain it to me. Like, okay, like if you looked at this file and you found this insight, how did you get to that? So that I know next time to like what to look for.
It's funny because there's so many, you know, existing file formats that are out there stylistically, way things are done. And like one of the most confusing ones to me is PDFs.
Yeah.
And to have something like, okay, explain to me structurally what's happening inside of here, is that sounds like a really kind of an amazing way of looking at that stuff.
I classify this as a superpower because one of the challenges that I've seen in the past when you try to learn something that is a little bit more complicated than Hello World, and I'm sure a lot of folks can relate to that as well, is once you start looking out for content online for it, a lot of content is very, like, oftentimes can assume that you know things, right? Like, I'm reading about the reverse engineering and there's so much technical content out there where they're like, oh, yeah, like, you just have to look at these offsets. But I'm like, but why? Why this? Like, why? Where's this? Oh, yeah, you have to, like, shift it by 16 bytes and then you get the value. But why? Why am I shifting? Yeah. Why 16 and not 8? Why, like, but they, like, a lot of this content just assumes that you have the knowledge, and a lot of these models are very good about working backwards and allowing to explain, like, oh, you need to shift this by 16 bytes because this is the size of this specific structure. So when we look at this structure and together, they compose 16. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
The whole container held all of this. Yeah.
So it unlocks a lot of these things where, to me, like, I really feel like I'm building a better understanding because a lot of this teaching material becomes tailored to me.
Yeah.
And I can ask dumb questions. I can be like, oh, I don't get why is it 16 bytes. Like, oh, hey, let me explain to you why is it 16 bytes. I don't need to post a comment on somebody's blog and then wait for like 3 months until they see it and answer it, right?
Yeah. And, you know, these are things that are not per se encrypted or what have you. They're, you know, in readable formats. No,
absolutely.
But the matter of like reverse engineering what's inside of it, like if you wanted to build that file format,
it's curiosity, right? It's pure curiosity. And the same can be applicable to like any other educational material, right? Like you can be learning a programming language and if you're somebody that's new to Python and be like, okay, well, in Python, how do I build an interface?
Yes.
Because I know how to do this in C#. How's the Python method? Oh, you have to do this. Okay, but like what are the idiomatic language differences between Python and C#? Like, what are the things that I should know about?
Right.
And if I look online, like, I'm sorry, but like, if I Google for something, there's so much blog spam nowadays, right? Like,
right.
You land on something and there's like 17 different ads and there's like one line of code snippet. 17 ads, one line, like,
yeah.
And with a lot of these models, I can just like ask it, like, what about this? Like, how do I use UV properly? How do I make sure that, like,
yeah,
you know, yeah, stuff like that.
That totally makes sense. So what are the best ways that people can follow your work online?
The easiest way, you go to my website, den.dev. It's as easy as one can spell it. I have all the links over there. I'm mostly nowadays on LinkedIn, Blue Sky, sometimes Mastodon. So you can check that out. You can, it's all on the header of the website.
Those are my three also.
Yeah. And of course, YouTube, because that's where apparently a lot of the folks that are doing model testing are hanging out. So YouTube, yeah. Again, DenDev, very, very easy to remember.
Yeah, great. Well, Den, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been fantastic to talk to you.
Thank you for having me here. It's been great.
Thanks to AgentFuel for sponsoring this episode, 1,000 agents coordinating autonomously. That's not science fiction. That's what they call the AI backend. AgentFuel is an open source framework for building AI backends that reason, just like you'd build APIs and microservices today. Search AgentFuel on GitHub or visit agentfuel.ai. That's agentfuel.ai. I want to thank Den for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player, or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.